Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode, on Thursday, April 11th, 2024, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. With campaigns looming, Republicans are hoping to hammer out a budget deal quickly. Fontes seeks attorney fees in Hamaday's 2022 election challenge. Republican bill would ban those convicted of collecting ballots from elected office. Navajo Nation moves tribal election date to match earlier Arizona primary election date. House votes down Horn school discipline bill. And let's get started. With campaigns looming, Republicans are hoping to hammer out a budget deal quickly. But with the state facing a $1.7 billion shortfall, doing so may be easier said than done. By Jared McDonald Evoy, April 5, 2024. Republican lawmakers and Governor Katie Hobbs have begun negotiations on the state's budget, but a deficit and partisan infighting could complicate plans to have it done by next month, like GOP leaders are hoping. Arizona's budget is currently facing an estimated $1.7 billion deficit, due in part to a drop in tax collections. Chief among the drivers of the sagging revenue are individual income tax collections, which were far less than expected following the state's implementation of a flat tax rate in 2023. And the expansion of the Universal Empowerment Scholarship Account School Voucher Program has cost more than expected and continues to exceed budget estimates. The current year's budget estimates the private school voucher program's cost at $625 million, with a total enrollment of 68,380 students. But revised estimates place this year's cost at around $723.5 million, with an enrollment of more than 74,000. I can confirm that budget conversations have started, but will decline to comment on details or timeline for the negotiation, Kristen Slater, the spokesman for Hobbs, said in an email to the Arizona Mirror. Republican legislative leaders this week expressed optimism about the negotiations, saying in a press release that they are anticipating finalizing a budget by the end of April. Last year, the state passed its budget in May after weeks of negotiations between Republicans and Hobbs, focusing on how to spend the roughly $2.5 billion surplus. A key strategy to getting a deal done last year was to divvy up the surplus among lawmakers and allow them to allocate the money to one-time projects. But with the state operating at a deficit this year, many of the expenditures made in last year's budget could wind up on the chopping block as lawmakers and the executive branch try to balance the state's books. Earlier this year, Hobbs released her proposed $16 billion budget for the 2025 fiscal year that aimed to solve the deficit with a variety of proposals that Republicans said would be dead on arrival, especially calls to dramatically scale back the ESA voucher program. The dynamics this year with a deficit are fundamentally different from last year, said GOP consultant Chuck Coughlin. They just hit with what they thought was the easy button last time, he told the Mirror. That is not going to happen this time. But Prescott Senator Ken Bennett doesn't anticipate any clawbacks on those projects included in last year's budget to get, quote, buy-in from conservative lawmakers. He said that doing that would be unfair because it would pick and choose which projects will come to fruition. I think that in retrospect, we probably shouldn't have put all $2.5 billion in on-hand dollars on the table for everyone to divvy up and spend, Bennett said to the Mirror. The bipartisan budget from last year was derided by some Democratic lawmakers who felt it didn't do enough for Democratic priorities. Some also decried the use of one-time monies for pet projects. Hobbs' proposed budget for this year clawed back some of those projects, but Bennett said he believes that won't ultimately happen. I don't think we will see so much clawbacking as much as delaying into the next fiscal year, Bennett said, adding that it will be much more about cash flow management than cuts. Bennett, who was Senate president from 2003 to 2007, has seen his fair share of tough budget talks as the state dealt with a divided government and economic uncertainty. The first budget he helped negotiate meant striking a deal with Democratic Governor Janet Napolitano to cut $120 million, which Bennett said was no small task. Any agreements on tough budget situations is not a function of time, it's a function of cooperation, Bennett said, adding that he believes even a tough budget can be negotiated fairly and fairly quickly. Coughlin is not as optimistic. Republicans are known for cutting things, so I'm sure they will come to the table with cuts, Coughlin said, adding that those cuts will likely be to state agencies or fall within the governor's policy priorities and will likely create further tension. They'll come with cuts and she'll come with clawbacks. Let the negotiations begin. Coughlin also pointed to the Republican legislature's partisan makeup, in particular the far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus, whose members could act as a thorn in the side of negotiations or even approval of the budget. That creates substantial problems, not just for Hobbs, but for House Speaker Ben Thoma, because Thoma's got to manage his caucus, Coughlin said. The Arizona Freedom Caucus has at times butted heads with Republican leadership. Last session, during a contentious late-night vote on the state budget, Thoma and Freedom Caucus leader Senator Jake Hoffman, a Republican from Queen Creek, butted heads. Coughlin also said he does not believe that the projections by Republican leadership of finalizing a budget this month will likely come to fruition. They're thinking they're going to go in and propose a Republican budget, and she is just going to have to swallow that, and I don't think she is, he said. However, Coughlin said he doesn't anticipate any big policy wins for Hobbs, as he anticipates she is waiting to see what will change in the legislature come November of this year. In both chambers, Republicans only hold a one-seat majority. The dice are going to get rolled in 24, and you're going to get a whole new cast of characters, Coughlin said. If I'm Hobbs, I just try to get through this year. Requests for comment to both Democratic and Republican leadership in the House and Senate went unreturned. And that concludes this first story. With campaigns looming, Republicans are hoping to hammer out a budget deal quickly. Our next story, Fontes seeks attorney fees in Hamaday's 2022 election challenge, by Gloria Rebecca Gomez, April 5, 2024. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes is seeking $36,820 in attorney fees from Abraham Hamaday after the Republican's latest attempt to take the office he lost 2 years ago was thrown out of court. Fontes, who oversees election procedures across the state, denounced the legal challenge Hamaday launched against Maricopa County's election processes and said that Hamaday should reimburse the costs racked up to defend against it. This representation required intricate and important work, including matters of statewide importance, and concerned parties of significant prominence and character. This action should never have been filed, and the fees incurred were necessarily expended to achieve total success, wrote attorney Craig Morgan. Hamaday, who lives in Scottsdale and is hoping to represent a West Valley district in Congress this November, filed a writ of quo warranto in January, urging Maricopa County Superior Court to depose Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays and install him in the office instead. Mays, a Democrat, won the 2022 midterm election by just 280 votes. That defeat prompted Hamidi to mount a series of legal challenges to convince the courts that the election was unlawfully run, many of which failed to move forward for lack of convincing evidence. The latest challenge centered around allegations that the election, which delivered Mays her seat, was marred by illegal voter verification procedures. In his filing, Hamidi argued that he deserved to be the state's top attorney because the election that Mays won was unfairly swayed by illegal signature verification processes used in the state's most populous county. Maricopa County election officials, Hamidi's attorney claimed, allowed the signatures on mail-in ballot affidavits in the 2022 election to be checked against ballot signatures submitted during past elections. State law, Hamidi's campaign said, only allows cross-referencing a ballot signature against that person's voter registration form. The way election officials verify mail-in ballots has been a frequent source of contention among Republicans, despite the fact that the practice of using historical ballot signatures to verify new ballots has existed since the Election Procedures Manual, which has the force of law, was updated in 2019 to allow for comparisons to all documents in a person's entire voting record. Hamidi's campaign has attempted to make the same argument in more than one lawsuit, and each time has been notified that the courts have consistently held that issues with how elections are run must be raised before the election is carried out. Judge Susana Pineda was unimpressed by the rehashing of old and previously rejected arguments, ruling that the filing was groundless and made in bad faith. Pineda instructed defendants Fontes and Mays to submit their motions to recoup attorney's fees by April 22nd. Richie Taylor, a spokesperson for Mays, said her motion has not yet been filed. Pineda also authorized sanctions against Hamidi and his attorney, Ryan Heath. Arizona law punishes unjustified actions with a $5,000 fine. And that concludes this story. Fontes seeks attorney's fees in Hamidi's 2022 election challenge. Our next story, Republican bill would ban those convicted of collecting ballots from elected office, by Caitlin Sievers, April 4, 2024. A city councilwoman in a small southwestern Arizona city was convicted of a misdemeanor for illegally collecting and depositing 7 early ballots in the 2022 primary election. Republicans want to ensure anyone else who does so won't ever be able to hold elected office. GOP state lawmakers have crafted and passed a bill that would bar anyone who is convicted of ballot abuse from holding elected office and would force them to resign if convicted while holding public office. Representative Tim Dunn, a Republican from Yuma, who sponsored House Bill 2612, made it clear that the bill was a reaction to illegal ballot collections by longtime San Luis City Councilwoman Gloria Lopez-Torres in 2020, even though the bill would not retroactively impact her. Lopez-Torres was convicted last year of misdemeanor ballot abuse, and as a special requirement of her sentence, she won't be permitted to run for or be appointed to public office again, although she is being allowed to serve out the rest of her term, which ends in December. 3 other Democrat women, one of them the former mayor of San Luis, were also convicted of ballot abuse in the same election. Lopez-Torres did not respond to requests for comment on the bill. Several Democratic critics of the bill, like Senator Priya Sundaresan, a Democrat from Tucson, pointed out that there are numerous other election crimes that seem objectively worse than collecting other people's ballots that Dunn didn't opt to include in the bill. Those include things like tampering with election software, changing a person's vote, and forging election returns, just to name a few. Collecting the marked early ballots of people who are not family members or housemates was legal in Arizona until 2016, when Republicans in the legislature voted to make it illegal. The practice is pejoratively referred to as ballot harvesting by critics. The former mayor of San Luis, Guillermina Fuentes and Alma Juarez, her neighbor, were the first people to be prosecuted or convicted of ballot collection in 2022. Allies of former President Donald Trump say their convictions are indicative of the type of voter fraud that cost him the 2020 election. But democracy advocates say persecuting these cases suppresses the right to vote. Lopez Torres' appointment as vice mayor of the San Luis City Council in January resulted in a flurry of articles on right-wing media platforms with headlines like, "Convicted Democrat election fraudster is appointed vice mayor of Arizona City." It is illegal to harvest ballots, Dunn said during a March 18th Senate Elections Committee meeting. When you plead guilty, you should have consequences. He argued that someone convicted of ballot collection should not have any oversight power when it comes to elections, even the limited power a city council has in city elections. Representative Cesar Aguilar, a Democrat from Phoenix, told his colleagues on February 29th, when the House of Representatives debated the bill, that ballot collection shouldn't be a crime. One person has one vote, and giving someone you trust the ability to drop off your ballot should be legal, he said. Representative Teresa Martinez, a Republican from Casa Grande, clapped back that it should absolutely be against the law. Our ballot is a very sacred thing, and handing it off to a perfect stranger who is collecting 90 of them is insane, she said. Lopez Torres and the other three women who were convicted of ballot abuse in the 2020 primary election were convicted for gathering and submitting a total of 12 early ballots. Representative Mariana Sandoval, a Democrat from Goodyear, responded that the intent of making ballot collection illegal was to go after people collecting large quantities of ballots, not a person's neighbors who offer to turn in your ballot with their own. Sandoval reminded the other lawmakers that there is no mail delivery in San Luis. They have to drive to the post office and pick up their mail, Sandoval said. If they don't have a vehicle, if they get home from work late, if they don't have the ability to get to the post office, they lose the ability to be able to vote. Doing a favor for your neighbor should not be a crime. During a February 15th House Government Committee meeting, Representative Lydia Hernandez, a Democrat from Phoenix, pointed out that not everyone knows that asking someone outside your household to turn in your early ballot is illegal, saying she has a neighbor who has asked her to do so. Hernandez was the only Democrat who voted alongside Republicans when the House first voted on the bill in February. However, after the Senate approved the bill earlier this week and sent it back to the House for a final vote on a minor amendment added in the Senate, she voted against the proposal. The bill is now ready for consideration by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs. And that concludes this story. Republican bill would ban those convicted of collecting ballots from elected office. Our next story, Navajo Nation moves tribal election date to match earlier Arizona primary election date, by Shondine Silversmith, April 3, 2024. To align with Arizona's primary election dates and keep voter turnout intact, the Navajo Nation passed emergency legislation to move its tribal primary election from August to July, matching the state's schedule. Having two elections conducted 1 week apart would depress Navajo voter turnout and dilute the Navajo vote, according to the Navajo Nation Board of Election Supervisors. In February, Governor Katie Hobbs signed House Bill 2785 into law, changing Arizona's 2024 primary election date to July 30th. The change will only apply to the 2024 primary election. At the risk of holding two elections on the Navajo Nation in Arizona, tribal officials did not want to dilute the Navajo vote for Arizona's primary and local tribal government elections by making voters visit polling sites twice. Arizona is a swing state, and the number of Navajo voters is significant, the Office of the Navajo Nation President and Vice President stated. the Navajo Nation Council held a special session on March 8th to discuss changing the election dates from August 6th to July 30th. The legislation passed 8-6 and was signed into law by Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin on March 19th. The change will only apply to the 2024 primary election, according to the Navajo Nation Council. The Navajo Nation Election Code states that primary elections on the Navajo Nation are held on the first Tuesday in August for any year in which a general election is held and at which candidates for public office are to be elected. Arizona has one of the largest indigenous voting populations in the country, with more than 305,000 of voting age, according to the National Congress of American Indians. Indigenous people make up 6% of Arizona's overall population. Indigenous people in Arizona didn't have the right to vote until 1948, when the Arizona Supreme Court overturned a ban. But even after gaining that right, Native voters still faced obstacles to casting their ballot, from voter suppression to racial discrimination. Casting a vote at a polling location on the Navajo Nation is much different than driving to a polling station in Phoenix, Arizona, where the majority of Arizona voters live. The Navajo Nation is 27,000 square miles, making it the largest tribal landmass in the country, with a majority of that land in Arizona. Polling locations are scattered. For some voters, driving to their closest polling place could take an hour. Polling locations are only one obstacle that impacts Navajo voters, which could make it complicated if two elections had to be held for Navajo voters in Arizona. If there are two election dates, the Navajo Nation won't get the voter turnout for chapter positions, school board positions, and other important elected positions, Coconino County Supervisor Lena Fowler said during the special session. It would create confusion. By having the Navajo Nation primary election in sync with Arizona's primary election, Fowler said Navajo voters can go to the polls as they always have and vote in both state and tribal elections simultaneously. The Navajo Election Administration and the Navajo Board of Election Supervisors oversee elections on the Navajo Nation, and they are responsible for providing notices to Navajo voters regarding election date changes. The goal is certainly to have our nation prepared for a comprehensive voter turnout, legislation sponsor Navajo Nation Council Delegate Andy Nez said in a press release. He added that leaders must educate their community about the date change. Arizona Native Vote Director Janie Parrish said that the Navajo Nation Council's approval of election date change maximizes the voting power for state and tribal elections because Navajo voters can help win elections. This is more convenient for Navajo people to be able to cast their votes for both elections on the same day, Parrish said, and it's an excellent way to keep up the momentum. Arizona Native Vote is a grassroots organization that focuses on increasing civic engagement and election participation in tribal and rural communities, according to their website. We don't know what's going to happen after November, Parrish said. We don't know who's going to be in the offices, and we don't know if they're going to want to work with tribes. And that concludes this story. Navajo Nation moves tribal election date to match earlier Arizona primary election date. In our next story, House Votes Down Horn School Discipline Bill by Caitlin Sievers, April 8, 2024. The Arizona House of Representatives rejected Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn's plan to tie student discipline to school letter grades, with two Republican legislators siding with Democrats. Republican Representatives David Cook of Globe and Alexander Collodin of Scottsdale both voted against Senate Bill 1459 on April 4th, alongside all of the chamber's Democrats, striking it down by a vote of 29-30. Later the same day, Collodin asked for the option to bring the bill back for another vote within the following 2 weeks. The bill would require public school districts and public charter schools to report the total number of disciplinary referrals that their teachers make each year and how many of these referrals resulted in administrators taking the disciplinary action that teachers recommended. On the flip side, districts would also have to report how many referrals resulted in no disciplinary action from administrators. Horn, also a Republican, previously described the bill as a way to help retain public school teachers in a state where turnover is high and has an impact on student achievement. He said that the bill is a way to deal with permissive school districts that were letting students act out and be disrespectful of teachers, and that teachers didn't feel supported in disciplining them. Under the bill, if the district does not implement disciplinary action for at least 75% of teacher referrals without a reasonable justification, the school would be notified that it did not adequately punish misbehaving students. It could be subject to a reduction of their school letter grade the next year if they don't make changes. If the district doesn't hand out the adequate percentage of punishments in the next year, the Arizona Department of Education could reduce the school's A to F letter grades that are now based only on academic performance. Former teacher and Republican Representative Matt Gress of Phoenix told lawmakers on April 4th that he wholeheartedly supported the bill as a way to help teachers keep control of their classrooms. Having a commanding control of the classroom is fundamental to student learning and to the success of teachers, Gress said. When a kid gets sent to the office, discipline needs to occur if that reason is legitimate. But it seems that there's a greater interest in restorative justice, which is code for kids can do whatever they want inside of classrooms or inside of the school without any intervening action. But Democratic Representative Nancy Gutierrez said during a discussion of the bill on March 27th that the legislature was trying to overstep its boundaries by taking local control away from school boards. "This should be a school board issue, not a state of House representatives issue," she said. "It is my opinion that this bill has been put forward in order not to support teachers, but in order to make it so there's an easier way to have more public schools with D and F grades to support some of the rhetoric that we hear that public schools are failing our students." Democratic Representative Judy Schweibert of Phoenix said she agreed with Gutierrez and added that she believes that teacher retention problems are at least partly the legislature's fault for funding Arizona schools at one of the lowest per pupil rates in the nation. "The job of our local schools and boards is to make direct decisions that apply most specifically to their schools," she said. "We see the legislature criticizing public schools when we are not doing our job. Arizona ranks 49th in the nation in per pupil funding. We're pointing our fingers at public schools, blaming them for problems that we have created because of too large class sizes, failure to pay teachers enough, failure to provide support staff." Democratic Representative Quanta Cruz of Phoenix pointed out that black and brown children are more likely than their white peers to be referred for disciplinary actions for the same behaviors. "We don't need to be treating them like criminals when they're children who can be changed, who need to grow," she said. During his annual State of Education address last month, Horn said that teachers feeling unsupported when it came to student discipline was a top reason that Arizona teachers were leaving the profession, in addition to low pay. However, several groups that represent teachers and children oppose the bill, including Arizona Education Association, Stand for Children, and the ACLU of Arizona, Save Our Schools Arizona, and the Arizona School Boards Association. Culloden told the Arizona Mirror that he voted against the bill because it applies to charter schools as well as traditional public schools. "It goes against the entire principle of charter schools," he said. "Charter schools are supposed to have a free hand." Culloden, whose wife works at a Scottsdale charter school, said he has no issues with applying the law to public schools, and that he would vote in favor of the bill if charter schools were removed, calling Arizona Network of Charter Schools some of the best in the world. "This is a system that is not broken, and we need to stop the state from messing with what isn't broken," he said. Cook told the Mirror he voted against the bill because it might hurt public schools in the rural areas that he represents, where there aren't many other schooling options to choose from. He added that it seemed pointless to back a bill that Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs is likely to veto anyway. "I'm not there to waste my time for my district," he said, adding that he was not a fan of running up bills that the governor is not going to sign just to prove a point. And that concludes this story, House Votes Down Horn Discipline Bill. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Our next story, ASU Open Space Dedicated to Indigenous Librarianship and Students, by Sean Dean Silversmith, April 8, 2024. When Alex Soto launched the Labriola National American Indian Data Center at Arizona State University Library in 2021, he was the center's only full-time employee. 2 years later, he reimagined the center into the first indigenous-led and staffed library spaces at a research university in the United States. The newly created space for the Labriola Center officially opened on the second floor of the Hayden Library on ASU's Tempe campus on April 3rd. Soto, who is Tahana Odom, said this is the first time Indigenous people have led the center since its establishment in 1993 to be a space that supports Indigenous students and academia. Now, the Labriola Center has 6 full-time Indigenous staff members and 12 student workers. It is 6,000 square feet and reflects ASU as an institution and the land on which it was built. When designing the space, Soto said he knew he wanted to include Odom culture because ASU is located in the ancestral homelands of the Acamel Odom Pima and Pimash Maricopa peoples. The space is surrounded by artwork showcased in 2 ways: murals on the glass walls enclosing the space and a large painted mural welcoming visitors at the entrance. These murals depict significant mountains in Odom culture to let students know that we're still an Odom land, but the land also has knowledge more than a book will ever have. The painted mural showcases how modern and traditional knowledge meets by showing a book and traditional Odom staff connecting at the top of the land. It was painted by Indigenous artists Thomas Breeze Marcus, Tahana Odom, and Duane Manuel, Acamel Odom. Jacob Moore, the ASU Vice President and Special Advisor to the President for American Indian Affairs, celebrated the grand opening of the new Labriola Center and commended the hard work that led to its completion. "These things don't just happen on their own. It takes a lot of hard work behind the scenes to commit," Moore said. "I think everybody along the way has been committed, and it shows." Moore said it's been exciting to see what started as an idea and concept come to fruition. "We have Native students who aspire to complete their degrees in a variety of fields, from education to American Indian studies to law. This is a place where they can not only gather, but also advance their work in a very unique way that isn't typically offered at any major university," Moore said. He said that the center is an example of how ASU honors its charter, which commits to the health, education, welfare, and culture of the communities it serves, including Indigenous communities. Moore said Indigenous communities often get marginalized, but having a space like the Labriola Center shows ASU's commitment to ensuring equity for those who want to go to college because they can do so at ASU. With the grand opening of the Labriola Center, Soto said it highlights the value and importance of the roles of Indigenous librarians and library staff. "It's been 2 years in the making, but this is really 31 years overdue," Soto said. Soto said that having a library space dedicated to Indigenous students makes sense because ASU has over 4,000 Indigenous students and more than 70 Indigenous faculty members who are involved in many high-level programs across various disciplines. "We should have Indigenous subject specialists in all disciplines," he said. ASU also has an American Indian Studies program, an Indian Law program, and a Center for Indian Education, which operates alongside many other resources available for Indigenous students. We have all these Native programs. We need a space that can be a place to access pivotal resources around research and primary sources such as archives, Soto said. Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis said that the new Labriola Center is a point of pride, and it creates community within ASU, which is what helps Indigenous students thrive in an academic setting. When we talk about Indigenous academic excellence, this type of space fosters that aim, Lewis said, by ensuring that Indigenous students are welcomed. Lewis said that as an alumnus of ASU's American Indian program, he wishes that the Labriola Center existed as it does now during his time at the university, because it would have been a valuable resource for him. He said he is proud that current Gila River Indian community students will have access to this space, because the space is next level and will support the research they want to do. Lewis said he hopes the Labriola Center's model will urge other institutions of higher learning across the United States to take notice and replicate it within their facilities. Another part of the work the Labriola Center hopes to do is helping the 22 federally recognized tribes in Arizona with archive projects. Soto said it could be as simple as providing consultation on what an archive project looks like, because in his experience, many tribes lack the capacity to do it alone. That work is being led through a three-year project, Firekeepers Building Archival Data Sovereignty Through Indigenous Memory Keeping, which will allow the center to support tribal nations that seek to establish archival collections. Soto said having access to information is important, but it is also essential to understand the type of information being accessed. He said it is vital for people to know where the Indigenous knowledge is coming from and exactly how it may affect the Indigenous communities it comes from, because not all Indigenous knowledge is meant to be shared openly. Historically, Soto said, information has been gathered from or within Indigenous communities that may not have been appropriate at the time, whether it's ceremonies or traditional knowledge. He said the Labriola staff can offer that lens to process information and remind students at all levels to think about the information they share and how they utilize it. Soto added that the materials and resources at ASU have always been available, but there have never been Indigenous librarians at the institution to put it all together and make it more accessible for students and the community. Lewis said he appreciates the culturally sensitive research methods that the Labriola Center intends to use, because ASU is a leading research university that supports Indigenous research and conducts research on Indigenous communities. It is important for one of the top research institutions to ensure that there is an Indigenous presence to support that research, Lewis added, and the staff at Labriola can do that. Soto said a lot of the work he does with the Labriola Center he learned from the community as an activist and a rapper, but now he's a librarian. The main components here is to provide scholarly support to our faculty and students at all levels around our reference materials, he said. And the center has about 5,000 books that are either written by Indigenous people or are about Indigenous people. The Labriola Center can offer research support in a culturally appropriate way, he said, because a lot of Indigenous knowledge that is in Western formats is colonized. Unfortunately, there are things that non-natives have documented and given to the institution that are just very bad, Soto said, and it does take someone trained to utilize Western educational knowledge set alongside Indigenous knowledge to find the proper material. As librarians, it's finding the information that's appropriate and then being mindful that we need to share it in a culturally appropriate way, he said. That's the level of care we put in our service. And that concludes this story. ASU Open Space Dedicated to Indigenous Librarianship and Students. Our next story, bill making it easier to shoot and kill migrants vetoed for encouraging, quote, armed vigilantism, by Leah Britton, April 8, 2024. Governor Katie Hobbs on Monday vetoed a GOP bill to expand when Arizona ranchers could legally kill migrants crossing their land. Although the bill's sponsor characterized the bill as closing a loophole that has led to increasingly larger numbers of migrants or human traffickers moving across farm and ranch land, the results of the changes Representative Justin Heap, a Republican from Mesa, wanted to make to Arizona's Castle Doctrine law would have broadened the legal justification for people who shoot migrants across their land. In vetoing Bill 2843, Hobbs called the bill another example of extremists acting within Arizona's legislature. This legislation was written values property over human lives and incentivizes vigilantism, she wrote in her veto letter. This proposal would alter traditional laws on self-defense to allow the unnecessary use of deadly force and further embolden a culture of armed vigilantism and violence with impunity. Current law requires a property owner to feel threatened by an intruder that is inside their home to justify the use of deadly force. But Heap's bill would have changed that to allow for deadly force if an intruder was merely on a person's property and the owner felt threatened, broadening the circumstances in which deadly force can be used and justified. Heap, along with many of his Republican colleagues, have since denied that the bill was intended to impact migrants. But criminal defense attorney Jack Litwack told the Arizona Mirror in February that the change would give a much broader defense to people who use deadly force. The idea with the Castle Doctrine is that you are supposed to be able to defend your house and home, he said. This seems to broaden it to say you can shoot someone that's just on your actual property. Litwack said he believes that Heap's legislation would extend self-defense laws to justify the use of violent force, similar to the events that led to the murder of a migrant near Nogales. The rancher in that case is awaiting trial for second-degree murder. And that concludes this story. Bill makes it easier to shoot and kill migrants, vetoed for encouraging armed vigilantism. We're going to end this week with some breaking news. Abortions are banned in Arizona after the Supreme Court upholds an 1864 law. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, April 9, 2024. The Arizona Supreme Court ruled to make abortion largely illegal in the Grand Canyon State, reinstating a 160-year-old law that forbids all procedures except those to save a woman's life. Justice John R. Lopez IV, writing for the court in a 4-2 split decision, said that a 2022 law allowing abortion up to 15 weeks of gestation depended on the existence of a federal constitutional right to abortion. And since the U.S. Supreme Court eliminated that right in the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling 2 years ago, that law can't overrule the first one passed in 1864 when Arizona was a territory. Absent the federal constitutional abortion right, and because the 15-week abortion law does not independently authorize abortion, there is no provision in federal or state law prohibiting the 1864 law's operation. Accordingly, the 1864 law is now enforceable, Lopez wrote. And that means abortions are illegal in every case except to save a woman's life. In light of this opinion, physicians are now on notice that all abortions except those necessary to save a woman's life are illegal, Lopez wrote. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays called the ruling unconscionable and an affront to freedom. Make no mistake, by effectively striking down a law passed this century and replacing it from one 160 years ago, the court has risked the health and lives of Arizonans, Mays said in a written statement. Today's decision to reimpose a law from a time when Arizona wasn't a state, the Civil War was raging, and women couldn't even vote, will go down in history as a stain on our state. The ban will go into effect in 59 days. Anti-abortion groups celebrated the ruling. Kathy Herod, president of the Center for Arizona Policy, which backed the 15-week law while it was moving through the legislature and is behind many of Arizonans' abortion regulations, said that the high court ruled with an eye toward a neutral interpretation of the law and not to advance partisan priorities. Today's decision preserves a system designed to be blind to all but the law, and in doing so, it upholds the right of life for all Arizonans. In a post on social media site X, formerly Twitter, Governor Katie Hobbs sounded the alarm over the decision and vowed to continue working to protect access to abortion. "It is a dark day in Arizona," she wrote. "We are just 14 days away from one of the most extreme abortion bans in the country. But my message to Arizona women is this: I won't rest and I won't stop fighting until we have secured the right to abortion." During a news conference held shortly after the ruling was released, the Democrat called on the Republican-led legislature to repeal the 1864 law, saying it was the right thing to do. Two attempts this year to do just that stagnated in the legislature, where the GOP majority has the power to decide which bills get heard. But it seems unlikely that Republicans will respond to the renewed request. House Speaker Ben Thoma and Senate President Warren Peterson filed an amicus brief in the case advocating for the reinstatement of the Civil War-era law, saying that lawmakers never intended to supersede the ban when they passed the 15-week law. "If Republican lawmakers won't act," Hobbs said, "then Arizona voters can in November, when an abortion access amendment is expected to make it onto the ballot." To the people across Arizona who are concerned about the future of abortion rights in our state, who are worried about their bodily autonomy, who don't want to see the freedom of their wives, sisters, and daughters restricted, "You can make your concerns known at the ballot box," she said. Reproductive rights advocates are concerned that a return to a near-total ban will result in uneven health care access for women, as those who can afford to leave the state to seek abortions elsewhere will do so, and women who can't shoulder the cost will be forced to continue carrying unwanted or dangerous pregnancies. Morgan Finkelstein, who in 2020 was forced to travel to California because of Arizona's limited abortion providers to receive a selective reduction when one of her twins developed a critical heart defect, said that the experience was, quote, traumatic and should not have to be endured by anyone. Hobbs told reporters that while she expects abortion advocacy groups to help women access the health care they need, she is open to discussing ways to support that effort with other governors, including California's Gavin Newsom. Hobbs highlighted her executive order that concentrates prosecutorial authority for abortion law violations in May's office as the most effective strategy to prevent the criminalization of doctors by overzealous prosecutors. And while some county attorneys have signaled an interest in challenging that executive order in court, Hobbs said she is confident in the order's legal basis. "Bring it on," she said. "I would not have issued the executive order if I didn't think it was legally sound." Dr. Gabriel Goodrick, medical director of Camelback Family Planning, one of a handful of private abortion clinics in the Valley, told the Arizona Mirror that she's committed to keeping her doors open for the entire 59 days that the ruling is paused. "It is business as usual and health care as usual, and we will try to see as many people as we can," she said. But Goodrich, who has practiced in Arizona for more than 20 years, said she is confident the November election will bring change as voters flock to the polls in response to the, quote, extremist ruling. The dilemma arose in the summer of 2022 after the U.S. Supreme Court eliminated the constitutional right to abortion and sent the power to regulate the procedure back to the states. Then Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich went to court to reinstate the 1864 abortion ban and convinced a trial court judge that the Civil War era law should be enforced instead of the 15-week ban passed just months earlier. The consequences for reproductive health care in Arizona were instantaneous. An uncertain legal landscape led the majority of the state's 9 abortion clinics to provide intermittent services for months. The 1864 law carries with it a 2 to 5 year mandatory prison sentence for doctors who perform abortions for any reason other than saving a patient's life. And the 2022 law punishes doctors with a Class 6 felony and a revoked license. Women were cut off from potentially life-saving care as the abortion rate saw record lows that year. Whereas abortions in Arizona have consistently exceeded 13,000 since 2011, in 2022 that number plummeted to just 11,407 procedures. With 2 conflicting statutes on the books, uncertain doctors shutting their doors rather than risk prison time, and state officials vying over which ban to implement, Arizona courts were tasked with figuring out how to make the laws coexist. Proponents of the near-total ban argued that the 2022 law included a provision that stated it wasn't meant to repeal any laws that came before it, signifying that the 1864 law should reign supreme. But reproductive rights advocates pushed back, pointing out that if the 1864 law wasn't overruled by the 15-week law based on that interpretation, then neither were the numerous abortion law restrictions enacted in Arizona in the 50 years since Roe v. Wade was decided. And keeping in place laws that mandate an ultrasound, a 24-hour waiting period, and an informational consultation, among other requirements, meant that abortion must be preserved to some extent. The near-total ban was brought back into play by a Pima County judge who nullified an injunction holding it at bay that was erected in 1973 under the auspices of Roe. But the Arizona Court of Appeals later ruled that the 15-week ban should supersede its predecessor, with the judges noting that if the GOP majority legislature had intended to completely outlaw abortion, it should have done so explicitly instead of passing what amounted to a gestational limit. Less than 2 months later, Alliance Defending Freedom, an anti-abortion legal firm, filed an appeal with the Arizona Supreme Court on behalf of Dr. Eric Hazelrig, the medical director of a chain of valley-wide anti-abortion pregnancy centers. Hazelrig was admitted into the case to fill the role of, quote, guardian ad litem, representing the interests of the unborn in Arizona. The position was added in 1973, when the near-total ban was first challenged. In a December hearing, Alliance Defending Freedom attorney Jake Warner urged the justices to reverse the appellate court's decision, saying that the lower court erred when it ruled to permit elective abortions up to 15 weeks under the 2022 law. Warner argued that both the 1864 near-total ban and the 15-week gestational ban outlaw all but the most life-threatening procedures. Instead, the way to harmonize the two laws is by allowing the exception baked into the 15-week law for immediately life-threatening situations to modify the requirements of the 1864 law, he said. Until 15 weeks, Warner explained, all abortions would be prohibited unless the mother's life is in danger, as the 1864 law mandates. After the 15-week point, the threshold for obtaining an abortion would be raised so that only immediately life-threatening emergencies would merit a procedure. A cancer patient, Warner said, is facing a life-threatening situation, but not an immediately dangerous prognosis, and so they would not be permitted to obtain an abortion to begin treatment. In a written statement issued after the Arizona Supreme Court's ruling on Tuesday, Warner called the decision a win for the right to life. Life is a human right, and today's decision allows the state to respect that right and fully protect life again, just as the legislature intended, he said. Planned Parenthood Arizona attorney Andy Gaona, meanwhile, rebutted that if the Arizona legislature truly meant to outlaw virtually all abortions, it should have made its intention clearer. GOP lawmakers in Arizona modeled the state's 15-week ban after the Mississippi law in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, under the assumption that the U.S. Supreme Court would uphold that law and that Arizona copy could stand. But Arizona lawmakers left out a key provision from the Mississippi law, a clause which states that any abortion that complied with the Mississippi's 15-week law but violated any other abortion law was nonetheless illegal. Gaona pointed to that as proof that Arizona lawmakers never intended to completely ban abortion. While the courts worked through the legal parameters of abortion in Arizona, the election of pro-choice Democrats to statewide offices 2 years ago dampened the threat of a state ban to some degree. Katie Hobbs, who ran on a promise to protect abortion access, issued an executive order in July concentrating the prosecutorial authority for abortion law violations in the Arizona Attorney General's office. Doing so preemptively barred any of the state's 15 county attorneys from using Arizona's abortion laws to take a doctor to court. At least one county attorney, Yavapai's Dennis McRain, who joined Hazelrig in advocating for the 1864 law, has indicated an interest in pursuing abortion law violations. AG Chris Mays, meanwhile, has vowed never to prosecute a single case. But the legal strength of Hobbs' executive order has yet to be tested in court. Shortly after she issued it, county attorneys threatened to mount a legal challenge against it, though none has since materialized. November 2024, the solution? Reproductive rights groups are aiming to stave off threats from the court rulings and GOP-backed laws by enshrining abortion access in the state constitution this November. The Arizona Abortion Access Act would guarantee the procedure as a right up to 24 weeks of gestation in a mirror of the standard in Roe. The act would also include an exception for procedures performed after that time if the doctor considers it necessary to safeguard the life, physical, or mental health of their patient. Because it is a constitutional amendment, the initiative needs to collect 383,923 signatures to qualify for the ballot and be considered by Arizona voters. Earlier this month, the campaign announced it has gathered 500,000 signatures, and it plans to continue collecting more to ensure a buffer against signatures that are eventually thrown out during the verification process. That's about all the time we have for this developing story. I'm sure it will be updated in future episodes. Thank you so much for listening today. This is the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again next week.